WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most violent children today, the young people that frighten and baffle us and seem most beyond reach, are the young people that Mary Previty tries to help. The children accused of dealing drugs, prostitution, robbery, and murder. Previty is the administrator of the Camden County Youth Center, a New Jersey detention center where young people accused of crimes are held as they await trial. She spoke with us last year about her work. We invited her back to tell us more. Previty has written a new book called Hungry Ghosts that tells how she turned the center around from a filthy, foul-smelling hideaway for misfits and discards to a national model in juvenile corrections. She wants the center to be a safe haven where young people can focus on education, self-improvement, and hope. The first weekend Previty took over the center in 1974, she had a riot on her hands.
When I arrived on the second floor, the boys were locked down. They were behind steel doors. They were doing a clanging, banging, just like bringing the roof down with the noise. That was what I came on. And of course, my officers are standing by. I'm a brand new political appointee, a suburban housewife, homemaker, and here I am walking onto the floor. I know you won't believe this, Terry, in a hostess dress. I had been giving a dinner party, crystal and china and candlelight at my home when they called and said there's a riot. So I come out onto this floor and my officers are standing by watching, because nobody believed that I was going to last in that place.
This was your big test.
There was no question. I mean, here they're standing by. These are people that had been punched in the face, kicked. There had been violence against the staff. There had been violence against kids. It went both ways. So they knew how dangerous these youth were. I mean, these are teenage boys charged, many of them, with felonies. I had not a clue what to do. The only thing that I knew what to do was to get up to the first youngster that I had begun to develop a relationship with, and I went to his door. His name was Stevie. And I lowered my voice really softly and began to talk with him. And I said, "Stevie, what is this about?" Well, you could just hear the noise level go down the hallway because everyone wanted to know whether Stevie was going to be a rat. So this lady standing there whispering or talking really softly at one door through the grate into his bedroom, everyone down the hall softened down the clanging. And noise is one of the biggest trippers of riots, just that awful noise. It does something to your head. It does something to your fists. It just like it sets you up for war.
So what did he say when you said, "What is this
well,
about?"
It was... He just, something about recreation or something, and I thought, well, you know, you could fix something like that. There were ways of fixing no recreation or not enough fresh air or something. That was something you could fix. But it really, it was sort of a listening gently to kids as to what was it about inside them that triggered this type of rage.
How else did the kids test you that evening?
Well, really, that was really it. It was like a test to see if I was part of the thems. The thems were officers that had been involved with brute force against youngsters. The business of mace. Mace was regularly used. It was kept immediately available in a locked cabinet there on the and there on the floor. And there were officers that would even boast that they just knew the way. You could get a kid fixed down real quick. You just put some type of a blanket over his door. You'd spray the mace across his radiator in his room and lock him in. And you could keep a kid choking and gagging for an entire 8-hour shift and have him out of your hair.
Mary Previty, you are not a physically imposing presence. You're about 5'4", about 125 pounds. You know, you live in the suburbs. You're not the kind of person who's going to show muscle and people will feel so intimidated by you that they'll behave. When you showed up that night, you know, during the riot, kids started asking you questions like, how much did that dress cost?
Absolutely.
Were you drinking? What kind of food were you serving? And now, when I read this in your book, I was thinking, well, if this happened to me, I wouldn't know how to interpret it. Because I'd figure they were testing me, but I wouldn't know, like, what they were looking for in my response. You know, were they seeing if they could ask me questions that were too personal, that I shouldn't be responding to, like what my dress cost or what I was doing at home that night? Or should I just respond and just be really open with them, you know? Like,
well, that was my feeling. The need to be open. I felt that I needed to show myself as an ordinary human being, because when you put violence and force out as your weapon, guaranteed violence and force is what you will get back. I could never win on that playing ground.
You know, as you say in your book, there's a lot of detention officers, correction officers, who work by the creed that if you treat people with kindness, they will see your kindness as weakness, and they will take advantage of what they perceive as your weakness. They'll take advantage of your kindness.
I don't think that's what you're describing is true. I disagree with it, and I don't operate my youth center from that. I have personally observed over 20 years that the officers that are most successful in connecting with young men and young women are the ones who come across as human beings that demonstrate that they really care, they're interested, they're absolutely delighted with the youth. That's the kind of person that develops a relationship. I don't mean relationship in a you owe me type of thing, but that this person genuinely enjoys young people, absolutely delighted in their silly stories or their silly rivalries, and you can laugh over something that they do. That's the kind of person that almost never gets the challenge of a fist or a foot or spitting or something awful. That's the kind of officer that usually can calm a scene when there's difficulty brewing.
So you took over the center at a time of riots. What were the first changes you made?
Well, I'll tell you this. The freeholder who appointed me and I chipped in together and bought a St. Bernard puppy. The kids named him Mr. Tim. Everybody had to be Miss So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so. So the boys called the dog Mr. Tim. We began painting the colors more like a teenage type of place with bright looking colors. We began to bring in huge numbers of volunteers that would do a variety of things. Maybe they would have artwork with the youngsters or arts and crafts, or we brought in music therapists from Hahnemann Medical School, interns, college interns to do things with the youngsters. But one of the biggest things, we said school was going to be the most important part of our day. Children would learn, they would like to go to school. So we began getting federal grants to emphasize the school. And, you know, it wasn't very much longer after that where we began to have kids wanting to go to school. Kids would want to go to the after-school volunteer tutoring period. And it wasn't that long till we were awarded Outstanding Education Program in the nation for juvenile corrections, because the kids were learning, jumping by leaps and bounds, because teachers cared about them.
So you wanted to create an environment that was safe, that was appropriate for the teenagers and kids who were there, that had some kind of cheerfulness about it, even though it was a detention center.
And small and intimate, because kids need to feel like everything right there is to help them to grow.
You wanted to be encouraging. At the same time, you knew the potential for danger and, as you say, savagery, because you witnessed it that first weekend during the riot. So what did you do to let the kids know that although you were there to encourage them and help them and make the place as kind of welcoming as possible, that at the same time, if they got out of line, you weren't going to stand for it?
Well, let me tell you, we make safety number one. That has got to be safe for children, safe for staff. My people need to go home knowing that they will go home to a wife or husband or children when they leave the shift. I have got to guarantee that safety to them. And children who come in, the first message that they have to be given is, I am going to keep you safe here, and I will see that nobody hurts you. And you may not hurt somebody else. I will see to it that you do not hurt anybody else.
You tell the kids that if they hurt one of your officers,
I will hurt you.
Or the building.
I will hurt you.
What will you do to hurt them?
Well, I will, in fact, sometimes if someone has just done something, I will demonstrate it. I will call all the boys together and I start with a positive and I say, how many of you know about the good letters I send to the judge? Oh, then their hands go up and they wave and they get all excited, and some of them maybe not have heard about this. Say, when people act good here and they positively take part in our program and go to school and learn their success skills, I write a letter to the judge and send a copy to your father and mother. I said, how many of you think that this same hand that types the letter to the judge about being good can type a letter that says you've been bad? Oh, now all of a sudden you get quivering on the bench and all the eyes are looking at me. And I say to them, I tell you, if you hurt my staff or if you hurt my building, I will hurt you. We have got to teach children the consequences of behavior, because a lot of them think that nothing ever happens to them. And the structure and the rules, let me tell you something, that has been the hallmark of our program. Giving children freedom does not save them. It damns them almost guaranteed forever. But you give a kid rules, you give a kid expectations, and you give him a pat on the back, you remind them what it is you're going to do to help them be successful, you've got a different human being that you're dealing with.
My guest is Mary Preverty. She runs the Camden County Youth Center, a detention center in New Jersey. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Preverty. She's written a memoir called Hungry Ghosts. You've lost a lot of kids from the center who've been murdered.
True.
Is there any kind of ritual that you go through at the center when one of your people has been killed?
No, we've never made a ritual just like that. Once in a while, I've gone in with the clippings or have sat down with the kids and talked about them. You know what the attitude usually is?
What?
They bought it. You know, I can remember a youngster that written, I had had so many stories written by this child in the student newspaper, and he was going to go straight. He had decided he was going to get a job and not sell drugs anymore. 2-3 years later, here's the story in the newspaper. I said, no, it cannot, this isn't, it can't be. Not Jamel, cannot be. Got to the youth center, pulled out the files to see, was that his name? It was. And I go back to the kids, and I thought, well, now, I printed the stories that he wrote in the paper, how he was going to give up drugs and how he was changing his ways. And then on the back of the page was the clipping of his being killed. And they all said to me, he was one of the big boys. Big boy means he was one of the main drug dealers. And he was shot down at like 5 o'clock in the morning by somebody that was going to come to get his money.
What are the funerals like now for young people who are killed? And what are some of the rituals, if any, that surround them?
I was astonished. I went to one of my youngsters. I went to one of the funerals. And the boys fill my head with massive stories of big cars and gaudy gold and clothes. And so I pulled up at the church, thinking there were going to be all these Mercedes and fancy cars. They were broken down jalopies. One car had a flat tire. There were all these people were down on their knees fixing the flat tire so they could quickly get from the church in the church professional in this car limping along to get to the funeral, the actual burial ground. I get there, and the children all have T-shirts custom painted at the Pennsauken Mart. And they go there, and whoever it is that paints them with spray paint, it was Dayglow Tombstones, it was in memory of, and like a rainbow over the tombstone, and all this in memory of, and then the boy's name there, and all these, we love you, all spray painted. And then all these children wearing white gloves carrying the casket walking toward the hole in the ground. And I just stood there watching, and then they all had a flower put in their hands. And the brother, who's a child we'd also had, was like the big brother. He goes over there, stands right next to his knees up against the coffin, and he does like a high five up in the air, just as though he was high-fiving his brother, and all he clutches is empty air, and he just collapsed down and started weeping on the grave. I couldn't stand it. I said, a teenager dead, and how many of the children burying him will be dead next week, next month?
So it sounds almost as if there's this whole sense of ritual that's developed around the funerals, the spray painting of the T-shirts.
There absolutely is. And then the back of all their cars, they have shoe polish white across all of the back of the back windows of the cars that say, in memory of. And as soon as they leave the cemetery, I didn't wait for it, they go out looking for who killed them. It's like dispatched from the graveyard to drive around town to find out who did it.
So the next step after...
Yes, is the payback.
You are from such an incredibly different world than the world that you work in now. I mean, you are the child of missionary parents. You grew up in China, where your parents were Methodist missionaries. You went to a kind of fine and very strict school for the children of missionaries. Then, as we'll get to in a second, you spent several years in a Japanese concentration camp. But I'm wondering, you know, are you shocked by what you see? I think a lot of, I don't know what the kids know about your background, but if they didn't know who you are now, they might think she is just going to fall to pieces when she knows the kind of background we're from. It's just going to shock her. She won't be able to deal with it. I guess I'm trying to figure out how you could come from this missionary background,
but I also come
strict background.
I come from a very tough world. You know, my parents had certainly seen other kinds of horror, poverty and foot binding in China, starvation and the tragedies of war. So I certainly have not come from a cream puff world. It's a different kind of violence that I find here, different kind of tragedy from what I had grown up in. But I certainly was not protected from horror and tragedy having lived through a war in China.
Do you tell the young people at the detention center about your experiences in the concentration camp?
Sometimes I do. They're absolutely fascinated.
What do you tell them about it?
Well, the whole story. Sometimes we'll sit down in a whole group and I'll tell them the whole story and they will just be fascinated. I was sort of a born storyteller, so I love to go and tell them stories. And often they're stories about me.
One of the stories I bet the young people really want to hear about you has to do with how you lost your hand.
That will shut them down to complete quiet when I tell them how I lost my hand in an accident. And all of a sudden, it's like I broke a code. You don't talk about somebody has one hand or something that makes them quite different. So when I open the door, oh, well, now that is, it's just mass quiet. And this is how I'll tell the story.
Wait, let me stop.
Go
before
ahead.
You do, I just want to say you are wearing a short sleeve red and white polka dot dress today. And your arm is severed a little above the wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not wearing a prosthetic device to cover up the fact that you're missing a hand. If you look at you in a short sleeve dress, it's obvious.
Very obvious.
Right. So for a young person who's meeting you for the first time, they're going to notice that.
Sure.
So, and as you said, they're not going to ask about it because you don't do that. So how do you bring it up?
Well, sometimes I'll bring it up. I tell this story for a couple of different lessons, so I may tell it in a different way each time. Some kid will say, so-and-so just got sentenced, and he was so nice, and he was only 14. And I'll say, let me tell you a story. I said, I was so nice, and I was only 14, and I one time bumped my hand upon a revolving saw. And now look how old I am. And I'm carrying a mistake that I made when I was only 14. Sometimes saying you're sorry does not make the mistake go away. So you have to be careful what you do, that making a mistake, even when you're so young as 14, can leave you marked for the rest of your life.
Now, you're marked for the rest of your life. You're missing your
mm-hmm.
hand, but you haven't let that stand in the way.
Well, I tell the story a different way. I say, you know what my daddy said to me? They love daddy stories. Most of them don't have daddies. So they just want to soak up any daddy story. I'll say, you know what my daddy was braiding my pigtails after I lost my hand and I was 14. And he said, Mary, sweetheart, do you know what your brother Bertie said to you when you lost your hand and he heard about it? And I was really curious what my little brother said, because I think he was eyeing my bicycle. And my brother, he said, now Mary can't ride her bicycle. And he said, Mary, sweetheart, you know what I said? I said, well, I don't know why not. And I say to the kids, it's like my daddy's words were written across the sky of my entire life. He didn't think there was anything I couldn't do. So that kind of a message that I can build into the same story, I don't know why not.
The kind of work that you're in, there's such a high burnout level there. And there's even a high burnout level for teachers in schools in which there's a lot of crime. And you just get emotionally exhausted by it, I think, after a while. And a lot of people understandably leave after a few years. You've been at this for 20 years. You know there's no instant solutions. You're not kidding yourself about how you're like working complete magic and everybody walks out of your center is saved. What keeps you going in spite of all the obstacles and all the losses?
The little gifts. I get so many little gifts every day, and I look for the short term and the little, because I can never expect the long term. And when a girl that has been in crisis and just so hurting will put her arm around me, will ask me to sit down next to her at the table, or a boy that I have just been working with a lot, or he and I have written a story for our student newspaper together, and I'm walking down the hallway, and Danny will reach across the hallway and pat my arm. I go home like knowing every day that I get so much more than what I give. I get so high from those little touches that you know you've connected with a youngster in a very private way. I have never been burned out.
So that's what keeps you going. You look for the little things.
Yeah.
So that way you're not, you don't let yourself be disappointed when the big magical things don't happen.
I never look for them.
Mary Previty, thank you so much.
Thanks, Terry.
Mary Previty runs the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. Her new memoir, Hungry Ghosts, is published by Zondervan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.